Come along now, come quietly. Come on.
Get hold of him.
Lock him up.
All right, you fools. You've brought it on yourselves. Everything would have come right if you'd only left me alone. You're crazy to know who I am, aren't you? All right, I'll show you. There's a souvenir for you, and one for you. I'll show you who I am and what I am.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the annual Pretty Much Geek Podcast's Halloween Horror Month. I'm your host, Marcel Delgado, here with, always, my loyal co-host, Alonso Castillo.
Hey, everybody, how's it going?
We're not in your red chair. I mean, you got a red chair. It's sitting over there in the far way back.
A ways away, but you know.
It's about a couple of inches away from you, but you know, hey, we're sitting down, we're relaxing, we're enjoying this beautiful Sunday afternoon. And we're here to talk about horror, because it is October, and as always, me and you lean more towards horror as being one of our favorite genres in film, and we always love discussing it every Halloween, at least, well, October. So, yeah. Today, we're talking about The Invisible Man. In the coming weeks, we have about three other films coming up. We have Zombieland, The House of a Thousand Corpses, and my personal favorite, and one of yours as well, The Shining. So, while we're going to be leading up to that, each film is part of their own subgenre within the genre itself. Today, we're talking about a classic. And last year, we jumped into the classics a little bit with Creature from the Black Lagoon. And today, we're going into another one of Universal's classic horror figures, The Invisible Man. Now, this is my first viewing of The Invisible Man, as I know it is yours as well.
Yeah.
Everything that I knew about the character himself through other forms of fiction, whether it be comic books, the iconic imagery that you see of just like the bandage wrapped man.
Yeah, whatever was in like sort of in the zeitgeist.
Yeah, like, exactly. To me, the idea of it seemed a little hokey at first. But the more I actually sat, when I was sitting there and I was putting the Blu-ray in and just kind of like, as everything was loading up and I actually started thinking about what the actual idea of it entailed, it's a very creepy idea. We'll get into it later, but I think there are some, if someone wants to tackle it, and some people did tackle the idea in whether through the homage or outright copying, there are other ways that you can handle this and take this into a different spin. So as of now, we have the 1933 film, which stars Claude Rains, and he's playing Dr. Jack Griffin, a scientist who is meddling where man shouldn't, as most of these old horror films really go with, similar to Frankenstein. And it also has its own connection to Frankenstein, being directed by James Whale, who also directed Frankenstein, along with Bride of Frankenstein. So this was kind of a in-between feature between those two films. And you can kind of see a lot of the similar tropes being thrown in there with both the reclusive scientist deciding and needing to go away and not be interrupted with the studies with his doting fiance and his peer who is also interested in the fiance. And there are a lot of elements that are kind of being perfected, I feel, in comparison to the first Frankenstein. But we have Jack Griffin, and he is an interesting character to go with. I like stories where you're given a character that necessarily isn't the main focal point that is generally given in other stories. Whether it be Walter White, Scarlett O'Hara, or various other characters in recent memory that have been from things that I've watched. I like the idea of a nuanced character, but this one in itself is a madman. Yeah. And he is a man of science that has gone down the south end, mainly due to the serum that he's concocted, which they've said before that the serum, which is made from a plant made in India.
Yes, India.
And it's a drug called monocaine, which actually has been used in several other fictional stories throughout TV, film, and literature. One of the side effects is that it makes you more mad, which you see throughout the entire performance through Claude Rains' fantastic vocal performance, because you don't see him until the very end of the movie.
Yeah.
And throughout that entire movie, yes, you see he acts and he's there, he's underneath the cloth, but the vocal presence that he had at that time is great, and I loved it.
Yeah, it was something I think we both discussed, is that I really loved about it was the fact that so much emotion and so much of what the character was going through, and even like how he would switch, how he would be mad one minute and then be very calm the next, and how he switched between that and being very believable. You know, he would say these crazy outlandish ideas to his friend, and then all of a sudden just in a minute just switch back to being sort of more on a calm or even stable mindset. And I thought the way, including his laugh, I mean, his maniacal laugh being just something so, like, it was just so good, not just for the time, but in general, it was just so good. Like, it was probably one of my favorite things about the film was I really enjoyed watching him be the Invisible Man. That's funny to say because I can't really see him.
Yeah, no, going back to that laugh right there and, like, dovetailing off that, I think I was writing down notes when I was, like, watching it in my room, and I the minute that laugh, that piercing laugh, I just perked up and just looked. And funny enough, that is the Claude Rains laugh, and the laugh in this movie and everything, just most of the character himself was the original concept and inspiration for Mark Hamill's Joker.
Yeah, that's cool you say that, because a lot of what the character is and his sort of how he emotes and reacts is very, very close to how Mark Hamill portrays the Joker. And then you can just see the connections there. And that's just so cool. Like how art always inspires art, you know? And that's the thing is with the character of the Invisible Man, I also do like how he was sort of sympathetic of a character, because you do sort of feel these elements of, like, I guess a little bit of like empathy for him, at least at the beginning, before he really starts to go mad. And then as you discover a little bit more about him as the film continues, I think that the way they kind of describe that, you know, he really dove into these, I guess you would say, forsaken waters, because he really was trying to make something of himself for, you know, the love of his life. And there wasn't much development to that. But I did like that at least they give him a big sort of like pushing factor, how like men who kind of get pushed into these, you know, turmoil situations are sometimes driven by good deeds. And, you know, same thing how you brought up Heisenberg or Walter White. You know, originally it started off as this process to, you know, bring money and wealth to his family so he could leave them something. And same thing with the Invisible Man. He mentions to the audience as he's, you know, recapping to Flora why he did what he did, was essentially to create the serum to become invisible, to go where no man has gone before, so that he could sell it and, you know, make something of himself, bring name and honor and all kinds of legacy to his name, so that way he could have something to lever and, you know, to carry on his name. And so it did bring a level of complexity, that he wasn't just like a mad scientist, that there was some thought behind what he was doing. And I think that made him a lot more interesting of a character.
And on top of that, I mean, the idea is limitless in what you can do with it, depending on, and I feel like if it didn't have to deal with the degradation of the mind that the serum does for you, if you had a mind with a lot of willpower and a lot of focus, you could have a very dangerous individual unseen to the eye. A lot of really interesting capabilities for that as a villain. As he says, he's like, just get one dose of this and you can have a man that can wreck. He can hear every secret and he can turn over countries, and by essentially murdering any monarch and just kind of choosing to have how the history of the world be whatever it is that you will it to be. So I think that is a very interesting and very dangerous concept to play with.
And, you know, I did like the fact that they made him mad and not stupid. Like, because a lot of the way the character, you know, like when they were like, oh, you know, we can catch him in a fog or spray ink on him or spray the ground with ink so that way we can see his footsteps. I like that when he ends up, you know, being caught at the end, or when he ends up dying at the end, the way they sort of like, I guess you would say, corner him and trap him, it makes a lot of sense, because, you know, it was a snowy day. They lit the house or the little barn he was in on fire. And so he had nowhere to go except out. And so, like, but even then, when they were trying to sort of lay all these traps for him, I love that he outsmarted them. Like, it wasn't just like he made a silly mistake and got caught. Like, when he was talking to Kemp originally about him being his partner, he was telling him that, you know, he needs to wait an hour after he eats because he needs to have food to digest or it's visible inside him. Or, you know, dirty fingernails can get him caught, or all these ways he's sort of...
Yeah, there's rules to it. He's not completely impervious.
And I love it, because there's, like, been a genuine concern and understanding of what he's done to make sure that he becomes successful. And it's as if like he went mad creating this experiment, but then while he is the experiment, he's still experimenting. Like, what are the elements? What are the boundaries of it? And I find that so fascinating, because the core to who he was, which was a scientist, is still there even in the elements of madness. And I think that's a really great thing that they did.
Yeah, the idea of the scientist that's continuously trying to perfect his experiment and push beyond. That's you can get either even more deadly results than that, but it's in this aspect, in this case, it's just like you don't really know what he's capable of and what he can do beyond that. Funny thing about this movie, as we open up and we see, like, you know, the classic Universal symbol, the NRA founded this movie. That was a nice little okay. Nice to know.
I didn't even know the National Rifle Association was that old, to be honest.
I assumed it as much. I'm not surprised, but I just thought it was a funny little, okay, nice, interesting little thing to go with. As far as openings go, the one that we have here with Griffin in the, or at this point we don't know who it is, we just see a stranger in the snow on a country road roaming in just what is a blizzard. I think it's a really striking image, and it works really well. After that, we get the inn with the very, a very eccentric cast of characters, all the likes, as which I wouldn't have them any other way, including Una O'Connor as the innkeeper's wife.
Yeah.
Let me bring this up, because this is an aspect of the movie that I think was interesting. Because in comparison to the other Universal horror movies, they all have like little bits of humor here and there, as you know, just as any film will. But this one very much plays into the campiness. Yeah. In the aspect, which is very much, it became apparent at when he's just having fun and he's messing with the village and he's just like running around with his pants on and he's just singing a tune or just making little like one-liners as he's like throwing like the old man's cap into the pond and throwing the little the bike away, and it's just
yeah, as classic monsters go, it's like he was almost like the Freddy Krueger of like the monsters past, where like he was this sort of still like murderous psychopath, you know, creature, but there was so many comedic elements to him, you know, and
he's a trickster.
Yeah. And it was funny because the movie, you know, I was expecting a lot more, I guess you would say, nighttime or horrific elements to there. But I think a lot of what it was sort of the idea of how big and dangerous it could be. Like you were saying, like what this being invisible could unlock and the terror it could bring upon. And that's what was so shocking. I think that's one thing I will say. I think the way a lot of people in the saloon and, you know, the innkeeper and the innkeeper's wife, the way they sold the terror of what this meant and how they didn't understand it is really what kind of like made it so appealing to me, because even though some elements were really funny that could sort of, I don't want to necessarily say pull you out of the movie, but were just kind of almost felt a little bit, I would say, off to where I think the movie was trying to be, or what the movie was trying to really head to. But the fact that everybody that kind of encountered him didn't understand what he was really sold the fact to me, like, okay, this is something that nobody has seen. And obviously, even in real life, I can only imagine being able to see somebody who's fully invisible and, you know, let alone ghosts. People are already scared of ghosts. If you knew something was actually there that could, you know, attack you and do anything to you and not know where it's coming from, that must be just terrifying in general.
Yeah, because you're giving a madman complete power. And I think the idea is simple. But seeing simple, or just, you know, just seeing people like in the countryside, like, or just people like, because this is based in Britain, I believe, which I remember you thought it was in America.
I wasn't sure, because sure.
It's a little,
they have, some people have accents, and then other people have like that, I guess they would, you would call like a like that movie talk accent, that like classic film accent, and usually it's more of an American-based thing, so that's the only reason why I'm like, okay, like, certain actors have that correct speech, and so then that's something that's usually associated with, like, in America or American filmmaking. Mm-hmm.
So that's classic Hollywood.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, because, I mean, the minute, like, the policeman started speaking, I'm like, okay, no, I already had an idea that we're not in America, obviously, but, you know, the when you get such iconic roles as the policeman and the innkeeper's wife, and even Rains to a degree himself had his accent and all that. But going back to what I was talking about, though, the idea of having normal people like having to deal with it and seeing their reactions to this is the best part about the movie. And seeing him mess around with them is what is more interesting. Because as it keeps, as eventually when Griffin goes to talk to Kemp, his friend, I don't really want to say it's more of his friend. I think it's more so just his colleague that is also still vying for the love of his friend's fiance, as he's like trying to talk to Flora about like expressing his love to her. And I get it, and I understand, like, you know, that's a general trope that we see in movies, especially older ones, also nowadays too. But you know, that when he goes to him and he basically makes him his slave, that's like, oh, I'm gonna need a servant, a visible servant. You're gonna be that for me. You're gonna be my drudge, you're my little bitch. But the minute that he turns into that, it becomes a very you see like the plans that are in mind of killing kings and killing normal people just to be just, to show that way you can, robbing banks, and later on getting rid of
I love that when he starts to realize more and more of what he can do, he just gets more and more, I guess you would say, just amped up at the fact that he has almost no boundary, you know, when he's like, we'll kill big men and little men, and just to be fair, and it's, he's saying that because, you know, like, there's no boundary to what he can do. And so he's going to just start doing things just because he can. When he robs the bank, he doesn't even rob the bank. He runs in, grabs a drawer full of money, and just releases it to, you know, the people walking by on the street. And yet again, it's like, it's not even so much that he's a hero or vigilante or, you know, like, in this and that, but he's just a literal madman that's just doing things at this point. And he, like, it's not, and he, I feel like as he becomes more comfortable in his invisible madness, like, that's when he starts unhinging even more and more and more. And it's really interesting how the only thing that really brings him back down to earth for a minute is when he sees Flora. I always like that when he sees Flora, even Kemp was like understanding the fact that, like, oh, he's calmed down, like he's realizing, like, oh, where, why did I even start to do this? Right. Like, I started to do this because. And then he gives us the big...
Well, it grounds him. Yeah. And there's always that, the whether it be the Hulk and Betty, or, you know, various other character archetypes, or that the beauty that tames the beast, and that is always a trope that's thrown in there, which it's classic as time goes by. The funny thing about it is this is all based off of H.G. Wells' book, classic Dr. Moreau, War of the Worlds, nameless amount of, like, sci-fi fiction that Wells is given to us as a society. But the original character of Griffin and just was more less of a madman and more of a man caught in between this with the circumstances that he was in. And Wells himself was a very as we were talking about, like, what he's giving back to the people. Wells was a very publicly vocal socialist and a very political writer. So he was very vocal in that aspect, and it became almost like this, the Invisible Man became there's a lot of subtext about society and a man trying to turn over what the norms that were in society and change things for the better of mankind and whatnot. So that kind of got put away on the side for more of a traditional story that Hollywood was going to try to show. I think you can kind of see a little bit of the roots of that in here as well.
And I guess it depends, like, how deep you really want to look into a lot of this. But, you know, like, I don't know how much this film would have elevated if maybe he was just left alone by the innkeeper and, you know, did get a chance to work on the antidote and sort of cure himself, you know. I'm not saying the madness would have gone away, but at least it would have, I feel like the effects of the Mono King would have then either subdued or maybe gone away entirely if he would have been able to find the antidote. Which is interesting to me because every time the innkeeper or, you know, the husband, it's almost like people or society keep beating on this, I would say, like, vulnerable individual who's sort of, to a degree, already starting to become unstable. And as sort of society and things push onto him, that's what made him become unhinged.
I mean, we recently just saw that the other day with Joker.
So. Yeah. So, like, it's interesting how I feel like, you know, so Joker obviously is a more modern film that has tackled that issue in a more complex and graceful way, I think, maybe this film. But at the time, I think for one, maybe those elements were, especially you saying what H.G. Wells was going for at the time that he was writing this book, I think I could definitely see clear depictions of that kind of sort of coming at play. You know, unfortunately for The Invisible Man, society was writing that in this regards that he was a murdering madman, and he probably should have been pushed a little bit because, you know, like, of what happens. But at least I can see those complexities being played into the movie. But I think above all, though, probably the best thing I've seen, or like the thing that shocked me the most, and I think I, as for you as well, I mean, as us being aspiring filmmakers, was just how well the visual effects and essentially practical effects of The Invisible Man were.
Night and day, the way that they, whether it was outside, inside, it looked seamless. It was seamless. And there was a lot of layers of appreciation that I had for this. First off, it's shot on film. Them having to, and because the way that the process was done was that they had Claude Rains in a black, in an all black velvet suit, or in like probably like a onesie, wearing all black velvet. And then they shot everything that he was doing, with whether he was in like the nightgown or in his shirt or whatnot, in behind a up against a black velvet background. They had to shoot that. Then they had to shoot the actual set wherever they would be shooting, and they would have to put both frames up, both shots of film, and compose them onto each other.
Yeah.
But when you get into scenes like the mirror scene, you have to shoot four specific shots of film. You have to shoot Rains himself in the black velvet, you had to shoot the black velvet background, then you have to shoot the mirror, then you had to shoot the reflection of Rains in the mirror, then you had to shoot the reflection of the actual room within the mirror, and you had to put all of that in, and it just works so seamlessly, and it's beautifully done. And this was only 1933.
Yeah, and that's what I find so shocking, is like the level of complexity that it took to do this, especially, you know, without... I mean, people already have a difficult enough time making visual effects on After Effects, you know, with the dozens and dozens of tutorials out there. And, you know, most of the time people still have to look up a tutorial how to do these things. But the fact that they were able to figure out a way in 1933 to do this on film, and then without having a, you know, like a non-linear editor, and having to literally cut film together and composite it and, you know, do all these things, and how... honestly, good it looks. I mean, even, you know, at times I was looking, once the sort of like magic trick sort of sprung up it to me in the movie, I was almost starting to look for, like, you know, kind of like any magic trick, you kind of try to figure out how they're doing it. Before, you know, I really discovered and understood how, you know, I was looking on the walls for shadows or wires, you know, when books were floating, when doors were opening, I was looking for wires and, or even just for shadows of Rains anywhere in the movie, and I couldn't see any. So there was so much time and care and put into this movie to ensure that the mirage of The Invisible Man was not broken, that really sold me personally on everything that it was trying to tell me. At no point did I ever not believe that there was an Invisible Man in this movie. And that's where I think this movie has fallen in that vestige of, like, it is such a horror iconic classic because it was just done so well for the time, and especially just being so innovative as well.
We have Da Vinci Resolve. We have After Effects. There's so many other programs that we have at our disposal. Shit, there are things that you can use on your phone, apps that can create that green screen effect. If you want to just put someone behind a green screen, you can kind of make it, but you'll still see the shitty ones out there nowadays. But this was flawless in its design, which I think that's the practicality and the roughness of it. The necessity of it breeds the ability for it to be that raw and that well done. Similar to the Planet of the Apes films, this became a series, and which we'll get into in a bit, movies that just innovated the invisibility effect, whether it be this one or The Return of the Invisible Man, The Invisible Woman, Invisible Agent. There are tons of ways that they turned... Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I see you smiling right there. You
didn't know... Invisible Agent?
Oh, yes.
Oh, I know.
Oh, okay. Like, well, yes. Yeah, no,
Secret agent, man.
But with each movie going into, like, I think it was like in the late 50s, they kept on pioneering with special effects, and to the point where it's like we have what we have now. It's daunting, and it's terrifying to just put yourself in that situation where you're just like, as a filmmaker, you're like, okay, we have this idea, we want to execute it. How are we gonna do it? Oh wait, no one also has done it before. Well, me and you, we want to make a bag move or something like that. we can easily just, you know, look it up or get an idea of how to make it done. But if anyone wants to be like, hey, I want to make a man invisible. Oh, hey.
How are we going to do that? Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And, so. And more than that, like, you know, make it look so good. Like, make it look so just good. Because, you know, for example, I'm as you, I'm sure, we both have seen the original King Kong. And obviously you can tell that is a, you know, movie being projected on a screen with another actor's filming in front of it. And it creates that dynamic of, like, you know, a huge King Kong, you know, behind them. But, you know, obviously for the time and how innovative that movie was, it's super innovative of, like, even how they figured that out. But to a degree, there's an element of, like, this is almost like how the way they had to do it, because they were still, you know, literally drawing out the blueprints as being some of the first people to do anything like this. And with The Invisible Man, I feel like, I think they took other elements of movies that maybe had done sort of similar things like that with compositing, but just did it so well in this way that you literally can't see the guy. Like, there's no outline of, like, the velvet hood or anything.
No,
like, it's literally, he's not there. And that's what I love about
when he takes the, in the beginning, the scene where the police and some of the people in the bar or pub, whatever, the minute he takes the nose off and you see behind the eyes and you see, like, the bandages behind it, like, that are wrapping around the back of his skull, which isn't there, it's just invisible. The effect's there. It's something that you can't talk about it. You just see and you feel, and you're just like, oh wow, it's invisible. Similar to, like, when you see Christopher Reeves fly as Superman, it's an effect that either works or it doesn't work. And yes, we have better stuff. We have far better equipment now. It's going to be 2020, but this effect is still magical and what it does, and I think that speaks monuments onto it. Upon also that adding to the character and the story that we have in that from Wither from Wells. That being said, I think that me and you have spoken enough about the film itself as it is. We'll go into the break right now a little bit, and you'll hear a little something from us, and we'll be back, and we'll be talking about a little bit more about the film, but also mostly about the legacy of the Invisible Man, what it inspired, and a little more after that. So we'll be back in just a moment.
Listen to them, children of the night. What music they make.
Welcome to In Hindsight, where we take a look back at films both classic and contemporary, regardless of nostalgia, but all with love. With the month of October comes the obvious. Horror, a favorite genre of mine with multiple variations in it from comedy, classic, thriller, slasher, and more. This is Marcel Delgado, and today let's take a look at a film that defined not only a genre, but an aesthetic. Long-drawn staircases, castles in the countryside, capes, and a debonair look. These traits define the very look we have of vampires, which all stem from the 1931 classic, Dracula. Produced by Carl Laemmle as one of the first in many horror films for Universal, the feature landed up being more due to its star, Bela Lugosi, who had played the role of Count Dracula in the stage production for Stoker's very novel. With a haunting smile, comforting voice, and reassuring face, Lugosi's performance, although slightly campy, works brilliantly. He's a serial killer masquerading as a nobleman, and as the film progresses, you see early traits of what will become the slasher genre. One by one, the bodies drop. However, there is no violence, there is no gore. For a story about a blood-sucking demon, what makes the horror within it so effective is the implication of it all. The plot itself isn't that impressive, but the characters, set pieces, score, the man himself all define the vampire for generations to come, and in hindsight, remains as one of the best classic horror films of all time.
Now that you have learned what you have learned, it would be well for you to return to your own country.
I prefer to remain and protect those whom you would destroy.
In Hindsight is part of the Pretty Much Geek Network, available on YouTube, Instagram, iTunes, and all social media. Coming back from the break, I showed Alonzo a little bit of what we're going to be talking about right now in the middle of the break. And beauty of Invisible Man and the idea and the concept of it is that it as a concept, it's very great, and it's very it's like a template which you can do. And they earlier in the film, Griffin makes a comment, and he says that with an invisible man and a little bit of this and a little bit of the serum applied to one man, you can have an army of a nation can have an army, and it can overthrow an entire nation without anyone seeing anything. And you can also have a slew of different things going wrong. I feel that it's an offhand comment, and who knows? I didn't read the original H.G. Wells novel. It could have just been a line, but I feel like someone at Universal, a producer, saw that as an opportune moment to strike gold. And because of that, we had Return of the Invisible Man, starring Vincent Price, horror legend.
Yeah.
And adding again to the pantheon of like having a great vocal talent as your main hero. But after that, we also had The Invisible Woman, which this version of that of the film, we had a scientist, a different scientist, had a machine that turned people invisible, and he was trying to look for a guinea pig, and he found a woman that was like answer to the ad that he put out there. And instead of the movie that we just had, which had a little bit of its foot in horror and a little bit of at least in sci-fi, this was straight up like a rom-com, just stereotypical, like it was like a comedy from like the 1940s.
Yeah.
I didn't watch the whole movie. I watched several clips and I watched a bit of it, but it was just interesting to see that. But then after that, about 2 years later, we had The Invisible Agent, which this one was a very interesting concept. And I, when I first heard of it, I wasn't exactly sure if this was real or not, because I felt like this is an idea that should have at least taken off, or at least I should have heard of more, whether it be now or in other fiction. But The Invisible Agent was about a soldier that went into over enemy lines into
Nazi territory.
Yes, and I thought that's a very interesting idea to for an action movie or to have.
Which is interesting because, like, more than likely, you know, I'm not too sure about the release date of it, but I can almost guarantee it was part of the propaganda movement the United States had to, you know, to incentivize and motivate
people for the war efforts. Yeah, for the war
efforts and, you know, the rah, rah, rah. So, like, I mean, as a concept, it actually does work pretty cool as a movie, you know, having an actual secret agent that's invisible and being able to, like, sneak around, get, like, intel on the territory and, you know, taking this sort of concept that started off in its element of horror and a little bit of slapstick comedy and sort of going different paths, because it is such a moldable idea or concept that you're able to make it all these things like The Invisible Woman, you know, the Return of the Invisible Man, or, you know, even like just a straight up comedy. So, and you know, like I said, there were elements of the movie that were just pretty funny to begin with. So I like it that there's a multitude of ways that they sort of took these films.
Leaning into the comedy aspect, you've seen Abbott and Costello before, you've heard of them before.
Yes, right? Yes.
I think you have. Did you know that they made a Abbott and Costello meets the Invisible Man?
No, I didn't know that. Oh my god.
Yeah, it was actually pretty. It was pretty good. They brought Vincent Price. It was originally a little cameo that they had at the end of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. It was going to be like, it was a last little nod, and then like they followed up with it with the sequel with him meeting that made the Invisible Man. He became one of their friends, and he helped them out on a slew of hijinks. I love that. I love the idea of that. It feels like if a horror icon met Abbott and Costello, they were exonerated into the halls of horror mythos.
It's like a classic episode of Scooby Doo. Just hijinks and.
Which I think you or me were you were saying that this a lot of this film itself felt like a little bit like Scooby Doo to a degree.
Yeah, yeah. Which, you know, like, and I mean that in the sense of like you know, they were trying to, like, you know, capture him, and like, there's elements of like, I would have gotten away with it, you know, like a lot horror Scooby Doo elements, you know, like, but it's just, you know, it like the movie itself, there was, like I said, definitely a lot of terror and, like, you know, to it, but I don't think it ever took itself way too serious to the point where it became unfun. The movie always was had fun to it. And so, like, that's kind of how Scooby-Doo is, you know? I think there's always... Scooby-Doo had this level of, like, you know, it's a cartoon, but they were serious when they were trying to capture, you know, any of the actual villains. And, you know, the villains in the film always somehow ended up undoing themselves. You know, they ended up undoing themselves. And that's kind of what ends up happening in the film. He doesn't undo himself, but the elements kind of got the better of him.
The original Scooby-Doo was directly influenced by these old horror films.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that being another, there being actual, like, connected tissue, whether it be through influence and whatnot, it's going to be there. Going to more recent iterations or knockoffs. The first one, and this is my first experience with the character, was from The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, a movie from 2003, which I'm like, you saw, right?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Great concept of a story. You get all of, get several mythic characters from fiction, Jekyll and Hyde, Captain Nemo, and the Invisible Man. There was, I think there were several other characters. I couldn't remember. It's been a while since I saw it.
Yeah, it's been a while.
And I don't feel bad for not having that be in the current memory in my head of what I think of. But that film had a version of the Invisible Man. But the comic version that it was based off of was a lot more darker. The film came up with a version of the Invisible Man called Rodney Skinner, and a little bit more of a likable character, maybe like a very just, you know, a rogue. But still, not a bad guy inherently. Maybe a bad guy as far as the law concerns, but not necessarily a really evil man. The version in the novel, or in the graphic novel, was a bastard. He was a rapist. They actually find him in a all-girls school in the middle of him, like, raping a girl.
Damn.
And, and it said that he had been doing this for they think the school is haunted. That's why they're going, they're there to investigate it. And it grabs onto another, the more darker aspect of, which is more of like a realistic aspect of, like, if you put this serum in the hands of any person, what they can do with it. And but, you know, hey, he gets his comeuppance at the end of the movie. He because Dr. Jekyll rapes him at the end of the movie.
Damn.
Or at the end of the comic.
Wow.
Yeah, it's I read the first I read a couple pages of, at least the ones that were involved with the Invisible Man.
Invisible Man.
Yeah, and the minute I read that, I'm like, okay, I gotta do a little bit of research on this.
My first encounter with, like, this sort of element was, I don't know when, I believe it came out in the 90s, Hollow Man? I don't remember actually.
Believe it was 2002. 2000. Or 2000, but I do remember Hollow Man.
Yeah, so Hollow Man was my first encounter with, like, God. I guess, the Invisible Man. And I don't remember too much of the film because it's been a millennia since I've seen that movie.
Yeah, Josh Brolin and Kevin Bacon in there.
Yeah, and so I just remember that a lot of the ways that we're trying to fight the Hollow Man, you know, the Invisible Man in that movie, were sort of... And even that madness, scientist... like, characteristics was also inherently inspired directly from The Invisible Man, which now I've seen. Because so much of that movie, like, just, you know, from my own recollection, makes sense now of why he, you know, did what he did and why he ended up sort of becoming that mad scientist. But Hollow Man was my first iteration of it. And I don't remember how good that movie was. I remember enjoying it as a kid, but, you know, that's all I can really say, you know, that's how much I could really say about
it. I saw bits of it on Sci-Fi. I remember seeing the Hollow Man 2 at Blockbuster, always seeing that little DVD on the side. I'm like, oh, that looks interesting. Okay, let's go rent Nightmare Before Christmas again. Oh, wait, no, everyone always took that VHS.
That VHS.
Okay, I'm gonna grab that one right there. Yeah, no, the idea of it was... I never really cared much for Hollow Man. I saw it once or twice on Sci-Fi, but it was one of those things where it's just like, you see a lot of because I believe the concept was that a group of scientists created the Hollow Invisible Man, and then and instead of, like, there being one specific scientist who concocted with the serum himself, so it was a little bit more of a, and that became like, we created a monster, and the monster is now going to take its revenge on us for being created and whatnot. But yeah, no, the concept itself is great. I find this movie, it's similar to Creature from the Black Lagoon, to be one more so of, like, I appreciate it. I don't necessarily say that I am
in love with the film as much as, say, Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, or even The Wolfman, several of the other classic films under Universal's pantheon of horror icons. I do think that there are fragments of this that I grasp onto that I do love. And I think that have either influenced other things that I do love now. But regardless, I did enjoy this movie. And more than anything, I'm interested in seeing what they have planned on how to incorporate this. Because I do feel, I know, one, they know that they're making a reboot of this version of this movie. Universal itself is, because they're not doing Dark Universe anymore. I remember when that was. I think this time last year, Dark Universe was still a thing when Universal was about to
bring back all of its monsters.
Yeah, with the they had the Mummy as the first one. That originally it was Dracula Untold,
and then that was axed,
and then it became the Mummy, and then that was axed as well. And then they just got rid of the entire content of it too. I remember Johnny Depp was supposed to be the original version of the that he was casted in there to play a Griffin, but I think now it's currently in limbo, but it's supposed to be made at some point next year. So I think there's a lot of striking ways that you can turn this into a very interesting horror film. And I think that the minute that you take it from the idea that we don't know what this force is, but it's attacking us, that maybe at least for the first act you can go about that, I think you can have a really interesting little thriller, and then you'd be going to more of a reveal of who this thing is and what it is, at least.
Yeah. And so just going back to what you were saying, like for me, for my take on the movie, I think the movie was, overall, it was enjoyable. It was a pretty short movie. It's like an hour and 11 minutes or so. As it comes down for pacing, I mean, the movie's so short, it kind of comes and goes fairly quickly. I want to say the first half hour is really mainly set up for kind of the elements and the roles of the character, and then the next half hour is sort of him being unleashed into the world. And I mean, the movie picks up pretty quickly. It's interesting enough. I definitely see this movie as, I can definitely see why people really enjoy this movie, and it's like one, like a kind of a yearly horror, you know, film they might put on during to get themselves in spooky season. And I can definitely see myself maybe at least stopping by and watching this, at least if I catch it on TV or on like an old time TV show, because, or even if somebody was interested even to the concept of wanting to see this, or just seeing even like elements of this movie that inspire them. Because I think for me, the biggest thing I took from this was kind of having an idea, which is like the Invisible Man, and really starting to break down the rules around it. You know, I really like how much thought was put behind it. And obviously a majority of it must have been derived from the book, but whatever elements were added in from the filmmaker's perspective, which is like, you know, for dirt under the fingernails or eating after an hour and seeing the food and all these little elements and rules that were kind of created for the character and for the world. I really liked how it really added to the believability of it. And so that's what I think I took from this is like, you know, if you're going to pick something, make sure you think of all the elements around it to make it, to really sell it. And that's what I really got from this movie. So I did feel like I learned a lot from it. And on top of that, I mean, it's an enjoyable watch for, I think, anyone's first time. You know, I don't think it's anyone's going to feel like their time is wasted. I think it really at least shows you how far we've come. You know what? I was actually something I had to do. Like, this would be cool as like a detective series. If there was like an invisible detective.
Yeah,
I thought it would be cool, like that a would cop, be like a PI, like an invisible PI that would work on cases, and because obviously he's invisible, he's able to sort of get the intel.
You could, yeah, that would be. There is no warrant needed. He is the warrant.
He is the warrant. I thought that'd be a pretty cool concept, actually.
That'd be cool. Yeah, the idea. I mean, more so, I grabbed from this was my favorite takeaway was the character of Griffin Rains himself. I feel like that's more so Claude Rains' performance. I mean, the look. The iconic imagery of the bandage wrap man with the sunglasses, wholeheartedly, that was, there's a lot of iconic imagery here that you can grab onto and latch yourself onto. That just does a lot and sells a lot of it to me. But, and as always, we're now at the end of the podcast and I have to eventually, and as always, we're nearing the end of the podcast. I have to get on out of Alonzo's hair, leaving his house. He has work right now. I have work as also to do, but thank you for joining us, you loyal listener. I am your host, Marcel Delgado. Coming next week, we have Zombieland. Whether you're excited for Zombieland Double Tap or you're just a big fan of the film as me and Alonzo are, get ready to know the rules and learn everything about it. If you want to hear more about us, you can follow us on Pretty Much Geek on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube,
and all the various other platforms that were available. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes, Podomatic, or wherever other podcasts you can find us at. We're all going to be on every platform for the most part. So, thank you for joining me, Alonzo.
As always.
And thank you for joining me, dear listener. Whether it be important, newsworthy, or pretty much geek, we'll have it covered all under our radar. Catch you next week.